Good morning, and welcome to all of you. I'm supposed to say good morning, but since this isn't exactly morning in America at the moment, I will simply say good day. Welcome to this panel discussion and community involvement on the topic Seeing Red, Feeling Blue. We have a panel of historians to discuss the 2016 election. The way this will work is I'm going to introduce our panelists briefly and make a few introductory remarks. Each of the panelists will then speak for a few minutes on a particular topic, after which we will throw it open to the assembly for your comments, for your questions, and for your participation. Although I think it's fair to say that no one who is up here on the dais is exactly thrilled about the results from the last 2 weeks, it's also true that we are historians and academics, and our primary job is to the truth, to the facts, something that has unfortunately gotten lost in the last 12 to 15 months of the country's history. So what we anticipate from each other is an objective and clear-eyed analysis of the election and a civil discussion with one another, and we anticipate that you, as products of a Jesuit university and as employees of a Jesuit university, all committed to the Jesuit university mission, will also undertake a civil discussion of whatever your viewpoints are. The panelists today are all historians at Fordham University and exhibit various levels of expertise in various fields. I'm going to introduce them in alphabetical order, which is how they will speak. I want to introduce first Professor Sal Acosta, who is our specialist in United States history, United States Latino and Hispanic history. Christopher Dietrich is our expert in United States history and foreign policy, especially in the post-World War II era. Professor Kirsten Swift, the lamentably no longer the chair of the history department, is an expert on the question of gender and history, the question of sexual harassment. And finally, Magdalena Tater, or Magda Tater, is the Schwitterer Chair in Jewish Studies, and she will talk about the European perspective today. My name is David Myers, I'm a European historian, I'm the interim chair of the history department. I'm only going to make a few preliminary observations about the election, and then we will move from there. The first of them is about the vote. It's about the vote in this election. And if we look at it, I want to put up first a chart. This is an ongoing chart provided by the Cook Political Report, one of the most respected political reports in the United States. And it is an ongoing chart of the popular vote in the election as it stands today. The top line of the US total shows where the popular vote stands. At the moment, as of November 16th, the US total votes are for Hillary Clinton 63,649,978, and for Donald Trump 61,943,670, and 7 million plus votes for others. Clinton has so far won 48% of the popular vote to Mr. Trump's 46.7% of the popular vote. If you move further down the line, you will see the Democratic margin and the Democratic 16 margin and the shift in that margin, plus a listing of the total votes in 2012 and the total raw votes in 2016. Below that, you will also see the so-called 13 swing states. This is the swing state as defined by a percentage lead in the popular vote of 5% or around 5%. And you can look and see that the individual swing states are mentioned below, but the totals for the swing states have Clinton at 21,243,000 and Donald Trump at 22,103,000. So that the percentages for Clinton are 46.6, for Trump 48.5. Again, if you look at the margins, and if you look at the numbers that changed between 2012 and 2016, you can pretty much much see the overall result of this election. Hillary Clinton has won and will win by probably 2 million votes, the popular vote in the country, in the 13 swing states that have determined the election time and time again, at least in the last decade and a half. Donald Trump has a slight lead and has won those states and will win those electoral votes. If we come back to this, and move down, we can also see that, make sure I get to the right point. Yes. If we move down to one more, we can see that the electoral vote comparison between 2012 and 2016 is also interesting. In 2012, President Obama won 332 electoral votes, and Governor Romney won 206. This year, Hillary Clinton has won 232, and Donald Trump is on track to win more than 300 once the Michigan results are in. But what you will see, of course, is that the track of the country has changed dramatically in this area here, the so-called Rust Belt, that runs from Pennsylvania all the way through Michigan and Minnesota. These are the states that changed most dramatically, and in the swing states that went for Donald Trump, along with Florida. But if you look, you will see that it is the contiguous states here that made a very big difference in the election of in this election. If you look at the county distribution from 2012 to 2016, this is a chart from the New York Times, you'll also see the way in which the blue, the Democratic side, weakened in some of the most powerful Democratic areas. But you will also see the degree to which in some of the rural and smaller states of the United States, the red area filled in very intensely. This will tell you quite a bit about where the vote was this year. If we go further, and I'm not going to spend too much time, more time here, but if we go further, we can also look at the vote by religious affiliation. And we can check this between 2000 and 2016. But if we look at the vote between 2012 and 2016, we can see that the religious vote, the Christian vote in the United States in 2012, went for Romney 57-42, but in 2016 went for Trump 58-39. The Catholic vote was narrowly won by President Obama in 2012, and less narrowly won by Donald Trump in 2016. If we break this down into white and Hispanic Catholic, and here I'm going to point out that Sal Acosta is going to break down some of these numbers, I'm sure, we will see that the disparities are quite significant. In 2016, Donald Trump won 60% of the white Catholic vote, and Hillary Clinton won 67% of the Catholic Hispanic vote. Jewish vote, other faiths, and the religiously unaffiliated went very strongly for Hillary Clinton. So it was, in fact, in some ways, the Christians of the United States who elected Donald Trump to be the president. If we look as well at voting by gender, we can see in this opening chart here, this is from the Pew Research Center, we can see the way in which the below line is the plus Republican vote for men by male, and in the upper line by women. And we'll see that in 2012, Barack Obama won the women's vote by 11%, Clinton won it by 12%. Men's vote in between 2012 and 2016 shifted dramatically from a Republican lead of 7 to a Republican lead of 12. And of course, not to leave out the youngest voters, one of the things that became very apparent in this election was that the Democratic advantage among the youngest voters declined in 2016. Final chart before I turn this over is voting preferences by race. And if you look here, Trump won the white vote by virtually the same margin as Romney in 2012. but as we can see, even though Hillary Clinton won both the Hispanic vote and the African American vote by large measures, she won them by smaller margins than had happened with Barack Obama in 2012. I will leave this last bit, which is the education gaps in the 2016 preferences, in case people want to bring them up. I will leave those for further discussion. But because I do not want to spend too much time here when I'm not an expert at anything except talking, I would like to turn this now over to Professor Acosta.
All right, thank you, Dr. Myers. Some of the things that I've noticed when I've been watching the news and reading the newspapers is how distorted the Latino vote has become in the news, in the national news. That happens because typically they do the exit polling by interviewing just a few Latinos, maybe a few hundred Latinos. We do have better information where they interview thousands and thousands of Latinos all over the country. Very specifically, in key states of Latino populations, like Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, of course, New York, Texas, but other areas like North Carolina this year, and Virginia, which were key states. And the numbers that we get are incredible for two reasons. One of them is very telling in the history of the Latino population in the U.S., which is that this time, the Latino electorate went up by 20%, which is remarkable. Historically, Latino immigrants, and therefore their descendants, tend to be highly politically apathetic. That has to do with the history of disenfranchisement in Latin America, a history of fraud. When you look at the key Latino populations, primarily Mexican, of course, about two-thirds of all Latinos are of Mexican origin, but the Central American population as well, in that the issue of fraud in those countries dates back to hundreds of years. So it is not surprising that when Mexicans move to the U.S., they do tend to stay away from voting because they don't see the point in many cases. So it takes a very long time for them to catch up and start voting. Well, this time, we have 20% of the electorate voting, of the Latino electorate overall, voting for the very first time. And to me, that's a very good sign that they have decided, one, for those who were not citizens before to become citizens, but for those who were to start voting, and they did in high numbers. Again, I was very happy to see that. Something else that might surprise you is that in the national news, we're hearing that Trump got up to 30% of the Latino vote. In some other area, that some other outlets, it's a little bit lower than that. But looking at the numbers, it is two things that you should keep in mind. That Florida kind of skews the Latino vote because of the Cuban population there, which tends to vote Republican. This year they did not. This year, even Florida went, even the Cuban vote in Florida went primarily to Clinton by about 50% to 48%, which is incredible in itself because they tend to vote Republican for the presidency. So they did not this year. But once you remove Cubans from the overall Latino electorate, you'll see that that Clinton won by a lot. It's quite incredible the way that they voted. So I will give you the national numbers. This includes, again, typically these exit polls will canvass a few hundred Latinos, at times a few dozen Latinos, and then project those numbers. This survey polled 5,600 Latinos all over the country, which is a very high number if you're going to do exit polling. The total was Clinton received 79% of the Latino vote, Trump only 18%. Which is, again, those Latinos who voted for Clinton were higher in numbers than the ones who voted for Obama. Clearly, they were paying attention to what Trump was saying about immigration. But anyway, if you go by states, you'll see what I mean about Cubans and Florida. Again, who primarily voted for Clinton this time. In Florida, the Latino vote went 67% for Clinton and 31% for Trump. And that is the big exception nationally. If you look at other states, like Texas, 80% for Clinton, 16% for Trump. But then look at the others. Places like New York, of course, is at the very top. 88% of Latinos in New York voted for Clinton. Only 10% for Trump. In Wisconsin, which does have a sizable Latino population because of all the agricultural workers who moved to Wisconsin and settled there, Wisconsin 87% for Clinton, only 10% for Trump. So those are looking at the big picture. Those are very telling because again, Latinos are voting in higher numbers and they are paying attention to the events nationally. I'll just give you a couple more things, again, to be optimistic about from the Latino perspective. One of them is that the population of the Southwest is changing quite a lot. In California, Latinos are representing a majority of the population, meaning that they outnumber every other group. There are more Latinos in California than whites. In New Mexico, that's been the case for the longest time. But it's about to happen in Texas anytime now. It could be that it's already happened this year. But by 2020, the census will show that there are more Latinos in Texas than whites as well. Eventually, that does matter when it comes to voting. Not necessarily that the state, so you saw all that red, not necessarily that Texas will turn blue just because there are more Latinos than whites in Texas, but that the other parties do begin to pay more attention to Latinos. If you recall when all the anti-immigrant legislation was happening in the different states, it was not in Texas. And that is because even though the state is Republican overall, they do pay attention to those Latinos who are Republican, and there are many. Texas has the most Mexican Republicans anywhere in the country, and they do carry some weight. So they do pay attention to the Latino electorate, even if the state itself will not turn blue. So Texas will have a Latino priority in 2020. That will soon happen in Arizona as well. And the last number that I'll give you, I don't want to give you too many, is that we know that these things will happen for two huge reasons. One is that the number of Latino children by far outnumber the numbers for any other race in the Southwest. So we know that in Arizona, those Latino children eventually will become adults. And already as it is right now, there are more Latino children than any other group in Arizona. That has been the case for a long time in Texas as well. So those numbers eventually catch up. Again, not necessarily that all of them will become Democrats or Republicans, but that they'll have more of a voice. And what you used to see, it seems like a very long time ago, but what you used to see in California with anti-immigrant legislation in the 1990s hasn't been the case, hasn't been happening in California for a very long time. Again, it doesn't happen in Texas, which historically Texas has been the worst of places regarding Mexican discrimination. Yet you don't see it anymore because Mexicans there do carry a lot of weight. So Florida is changing as well. A lot of Dominicans, Mexicans, and Puerto Ricans are moving into Florida. So in the case of Florida, it is very likely to turn blue permanently fairly soon because of those heavy Latino populations there. So I'll leave it there. Just one more number regarding California. I ran into this as I was looking at the Latino vote. The Asian vote, which matters a lot in California, the Asian vote has turned dramatically Democratic as well. They were paying attention to that. One of the distortions regarding the immigrant population is that essentially all the immigrants are Mexican, that essentially all undocumented immigrants are Mexican, and that is not the case. Mexicans account for only half of the undocumented population. Asians are a big percentage of that, so they were paying attention to that as well. So I'll leave it with the numbers, and I'll pass it on to Dr. Dietrich.
Okay, thanks. I broadly want to make a few points, general points, and leave my specialty now, which is U.S. foreign relations, to the side, and the specifics to the side, because we really don't know what's going to happen I think one thing that we all understand as historians is contingency of this idea that things can change. And I'm happy to answer questions about that. My comments are more premised on this idea that I see sort of developing us, that we're worried about the future, about normalizing what the future threatens, but that doesn't mean that we should simultaneously endorse the present that we live in. And of course, a lot of these issues that we're discussing about have a long past. Based on that consideration, I'm going to use my time to suggest some ways of approaching the question that was posed so often during the election. And this is the question of how far and in what ways can we consider Trump a fascist? There are various ways, I think, of coming at this. We can do really smart readings of Trump's own rhetoric and show very direct indebtedness to well-known fascist or neo-fascist ideas and tropes. The fact that Trump and members of his campaign or transition team or his potential cabinet tweet or discuss this or that neo-Nazi slogan or use language that Nazis use, I think is definitely significant. But in the end, for me, at least, the more structural question also seems very, very important. Meaning, what kind of situation makes fascism appealing? What kind of situation makes it feasible in the United States and historically elsewhere? And if we think of fascism, and we need to do some basic definitional work here, if we think of fascism as a type of politics that wants to suppress and even kill its opponents rather than engaging in debate with them, rather than arguing with them, if we think of fascism as a type of politics that prefers an authoritarian state over democracy, if we think of fascism as a politics that pits an aggressively exclusionary idea of the nation against the pluralism that prioritizes and even celebrates difference. If we accept that definition of fascism for the moment, then the key question becomes, what kind of crisis calls this sort of politics into the national agenda? When do people, in other words, begin to look at this as a recourse? When do they find this recourse to political violence in language indeed possibly in action necessary? What kind of political crisis produces fascism? In my mind, it's a dual crisis. This is simplifying greatly, of course, because we only have a little bit of time. In my mind, it's a dual crisis in which two separate things happen together. First, the given political arrangements no longer work in a way that allows for stable government to occur. Second, the governing arrangements, the specific governing arrangements, malfunction so badly that they forfeit consent of the populace, the trust of the populace in government. And this is the kind of dual crisis I think that we might be experiencing with what seems to many of us like a broken polity. So on the one hand, in the first part of this crisis, we have the withering of democratic practices in the state, whether it's in the legislature or in the relations between the executive and the legislature, or in the Supreme Court, or in the attack on voting rights, or the curtailment, the potential curtailment of civil liberties, or these multiple threats to civil liberties, or in the size of the carceral state, this problem of mass incarceration that we all know about. On the other hand, the second column of this political crisis, it seems to me as if there's a default belief among the citizenry, a disbelief or lack of faith in the government. This idea that the government consists only, or at least not exclusively, but mostly in non-accountability, incompetence, if we move on down the spectrum, burdensomeness, and indeed outright corruption. And this is the belief that as we seem to be constantly expressed during the election season, that power is exercised in a distant place, behind closed doors, behind opaque glass, by conspiracies of elite. They care about nobody but themselves. Now, when these two types of crises come together, crisis of representation, crisis of consent, government paralysis, political, democratic impasse, whatever you want to call it, we're in deep trouble. That's, to me, something that helps make sense of Trump's rhetoric in the first place and his victory in the Electoral College in the second place. Then I think we need to drill down even farther, sort of out of the ether of political thought, into the specific circumstances, the specific historical circumstances of the United States itself, and of the world that the United States occupies. In my field, we describe this as the United States in the world rather than U.S. foreign relations or diplomatic history. We need to talk about the fundamental capitalist restructuring that's occurred since the 1970s. In the world, we can think about this as neoliberal globalization. At home, we see this really, Dr. Myers mentioned the Rust Belt, we see this in the process of deindustrialization. We see it at home too, and we need to talk about this. We see this with drastic class recomposition and the reorganization of work and indeed the reorganization of labor markets, both domestically and globally. We need also to talk about the global environmental catastrophe, climate change in particular. We also need to talk about, very frankly, we need to talk about the history of white supremacy in the United States. We need to talk about the history of misogyny, we need to talk about the history of anti-immigrant racism, and we need to talk about the history of Islamophobia. All of these are sort of move in between the international and domestic scale quite fluidly. I think we can all recognize that. On the international scale, relatively, I believe it's really important to think about competition among nations for basic resources. Struggles to contain economic migrancy and refugee populations, fleeing shortages, droughts, floods, and also wars. I think there is some room for optimism. We had a lively debate about this in the hallway this morning. I think that these will reshape the language and practice of national security in the United States, not in an optimistic way, but towards in a more divisive way. And I think this is something that that we need to be aware of. In conclusion, what I see, the problem that I see are sort of these what we can describe as fortress mentalities. Idioms of political anxiety, or we can think of as, gatedness as a new social norm, a new social paradigm in our lives. These factors, I think, increasingly drive the authoritarian and violent tendencies within our nation of contemporary governmentality. And if we put all this together, we do have this kind of crisis enable politics that at least looks a lot like fascism to develop, and it's in this context that Trump has prospered here. I'd like to add a really quick quick note here. When we started to think of this this panel, it was in response to a post that you've all seen, I'm sure, on social media if not your life, was posted in Keating Hall. And let me just be clear, at least from my perspective, on issues of racism, bigotry, and basic freedom, there really is no compromise. There's not a lot of room for compromise here. So I'll finish with that.
Thanks. Am I? Can you hear me? All right. So I'm going to make three basic points. I'm going to start by talking about the history of women as voters in the United States. Because I think one of the things that I've seen so many times, a lot of my white female friends, it's on us for white women voting for a majority for Trump. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact that it's been one of those sort of eye-opening where, and it's now the case since 1980 that there has been, to a varying degree, a gender gap with women tending to vote more democratic because they tend to be interested in supporting the social services and education issues that democratic candidates support. So just to break down a little bit more about, in fact, what happened in this election. So Clinton lost white women's votes, but she did so to less of an extent than any other candidate since 2004. She actually fared slightly better among white women than Barack Obama did in 2012, right? So relative to the last three or four presidential elections, she actually earned more white women's votes. And in fact, she outperformed Obama dramatically among college-educated white women and among married women. She was the first Democratic candidate ever, first Democratic candidate in 20 years to win white married women's vote. So, you need to kind of break apart the significance of white women as a bloc and the relative performance over time historically. When you look at what drives and shapes women's voting, which is, I think, probably generally true of voters, but specifically about women's voters, is that party identification is key. That people vote based on their party affiliations. And that one of the interesting things to see about why women's party affiliation is that the Pew Trust has found that the plurality of white women have identified as Republican, and that in particular, non-college educated white women have increased their affiliation with Republicans. So we're seeing a shift among non-college educated white women towards Republicans. But in general, because a broad point that's worth noting is that decades of research shows that party affiliation trumps gender in voting. That's a kind of bottom line base point to make. Still, there is a gender gap. And we saw that earlier. David showed us that chart. Clinton won 54% of women's votes and 42% of men's. And it's really, really important to move away from a kind of blanket narrative of women's abandonment because that makes invisible the mass voting by women of color for Clinton. So it's even Latina women voted at, I think it's 86% for Clinton. African-American women voted at 94% for Clinton. So if you're looking at female base for the Democratic Party, looking at voters of color is a really important place to recognize. And to think again, if party identification trumps gender, why Latinas and Black women have a strong party identification with the Democrats, and we can play a little bit more with that. So that's one point I wanted to make. The second is I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea that the disaffected white voter is a man, that we're talking about white working class disaffection, and that the people whose jobs have been threatened and economic well-being is at stake in the Rust Belt is men's. Because in fact, because of the ways that assortment, we call it technically, but it's the ways that people partner up, right? Whether you marry or partner up with someone else. Like partners with like, right? So people with similar educational, class, racial backgrounds tend to, on average, partner with similar folks. So if you're a white working class man, it's very likely that you're partnered with a white working class woman. And white working class women have faced even deeper structural effects from the transformations in the economy that Professor Dietrich was talking about. So when we talk about deindustrialization, we're talking about a certain kind of loss of unionized industrial work that was the preserve, the prerogative of white men. What's happened is that you've seen a dramatic expansion of white women, women's labor force participation in general, but including white women's labor force participation, and they tend to be employed in the new areas of the economy, in the fastest growing sectors of the economy, and those are the pink collar zones, the service sector zones, home health aides, hospital workers, people, restaurant workers, hotel maids, people who are employed in this sort of vast, growing swath of service employment. But what we know about service employment is when it's female-dominated. Female-dominated occupations still pay, have a dramatic gender wage gap. So that if you think about the households that may have been households where white women and white men voted for Trump alike, think about the economic stress that those households are facing that are tied not just to men's labor force patterns, but to women's labor force patterns. And on top of that, there's very clear evidence that men have taken up relatively little of the slack around household responsibilities. So that women, and again, by the way, I'm emphasizing white women here, but I want to make it clear that those wage gaps, those household responsibility dimensions extend to all women, regardless of class and race. Nevertheless, I want to focus in on this group in particular, because women are bearing more responsibility for family earnings. It's something like in 63.3% of American households, women are the sole primary or co-breadwinner. So they're major household providers, and they're still carrying primary responsibility for children and household well-being. So they're feeling stretched in an utterly different way from those white working class men that have been so at the front of the narrative. The last thing I want to say is just that shift. There's very good, sort of pretty good studies out there that show that sort of tipping of the balance towards female breadwinning and significant contribution to household earning creates gender anxiety, and that it produces stress and strain for men and women in those relationships and creates internal tension in those households. And there's, you know, you can look at divorce rates and other kinds of things, but I'll leave it at that. So I want to point out, I said already that women of color face pretty much the same dimensions of employment strain and household responsibility in terms of wage gaps. Their wage gaps are greater than white working class women's. The kinds of occupations they're filling, they're similar to those pink collar sectors. So if we wanted to talk about a place where we might think about building coalitions of shared interests, there's been long-standing work by some really interesting unions, particularly the Hotel Workers Union, the Restaurant Employees Union, some of the people working to unite with home healthcare aides. There may be space there to think about building coalitions across race and class rooted in these patterns of women's employment. So I throw that out there as a thing to talk about. Last thing I wanted to do was just make a few points about the implications of Trump's election for reproductive rights. And I'm not going to say anything particularly profound here, but I just wanted to put out on the floor the sort of key dimensions of what are the implications of his election. First of all, what's going to happen with Roe v. Wade and legalized abortion? Right now, Trump has reaffirmed immediately post-election his commitment to overturn Roe v. Wade, to appoint Supreme Court justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade, and to end legalized abortion. At the moment, we have one opening on the Supreme Court. That opening was that position was held by Antonin Scalia, who was an opponent of Roe v. Wade. So, nevertheless, there's only one opening on the Supreme Court, so we would retain the divided 5-4 court that seems likely to uphold Roe v. Wade. If he's able to appoint an additional Supreme Court justice, then, and we know that Justices Kennedy, Breyer, and Ginsburg are all in their late 70s and 80s. So that's a possibility. If the Supreme Court were to reverse the legalization of abortion as a national constitutional right, legal status would likely return to the state level. So for example, New York State had legalized abortion in 1970, and those kinds of laws remain on the books in many states. So abortion availability would be a state-by-state determination. What kinds of restrictions on abortion are we likely to see? President-elect Trump has called for a ban on all abortions after 20 weeks and has reaffirmed his ban, and certainly his vice president, Mike Pence, is a strong proponent of late-term abortions. There's some up in the air about whether restrictive late laws that had already been waiting periods, consent laws, these kinds of things that have been by the Supreme Court in the past relatively limited. It's a little unclear whether the shifting composition of the court and whether the shifting composition of the Justice Department would mean less effort at the national level to take on some of these state laws. It's very clear that Trump and the Republican Congress will retain the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment is the federal law which restricts funding of abortions for any, Medicare and Medicaid, any federally funded abortions, and that's been extended to women serving in the military, women working in a variety of other federal employment locations. President Trump has also announced that he will repeal the Affordable Care Act with its provisions for coverage of contraception, mandatory coverage of contraception, and that he will withdraw all funding for Planned Parenthood. So I think that's the likely landscape that we'll be looking at on that front.
Okay, so I am the only Europeanist here, both as a scholar and also someone who grew up in under dictatorship in Eastern Europe. So this election is particularly chilling, and one of the aspects is that we start with facts, that in fact it was an election post-evidence society at some level. It was deeply emotional, it was based in emotion. Emotions were being used by both sides, fear, despair, and the combination of despair in an atmosphere of sort of post-economic crisis, and both Professor Dietrich and Professor Swint have outlined some of the American context of the sense of disenchantment of economic despair. In societies that are not homogeneous, usually gets channeled onto some sort of an other, usually ethnic or religious groups. The European historians have been, you may have seen many comparisons between Germany in the 1930s and current United States. Of course, the United States is not Weimar Germany, but some of the factors behind the rise of Adolf Hitler and some of the dictatorships in 20th century Europe, and also some of the things that go through, if you go back to the 19th century, are at play here as well. And the question for the Americans is how much the American political system can withhold it, and I don't think this has been checked and challenged, and both in courts and other places. In Europe currently, you probably have heard, is experiencing a similar wave of nativist and right-wing movements. We've seen it in Poland, we've seen it in Hungary, we've seen it with Brexit, we've seen it with the Russia under Vladimir Putin. So America is, and of course Israel as well, America is part of that shift. It's not the exceptional America as it likes to see itself. And another lens and another area, and I think European historians are, again, we're not alarmist, but we're alarmed. It's all contingent. It doesn't mean that the train is now going downhill and doesn't have brakes on. developed states. And scholars have obviously studied Europe, the European context quite a bit. And what one of the historians, Jutta Bauer, pointed out is that this this is possible when an intellectual, or like for him, when an intellectual or pseudo-intellectual meet with genocidal program, whether explicit or implicit, achieves power in a crisis-ridden society for economic, social, and political reasons that have nothing to do with the genocidal program, then if that elite can draw the intellectual strata to its side, genocide, and we don't have to use the word genocide here, will become possible. And what is alarming is that we're seeing some of it happening in the United States right now. That is, we see the policies of stigmatizing religious groups, Muslims in particular. We see the proposition that is now being actually taken quite seriously of creating a registry. We see targeting of ethnic groups, especially Mexicans and other, again, immigrants. And as we've heard from Professor Acosta, it's not all immigrants are Mexican, but that Latino population is being targeted, proposing deportations. Again, once you you have to understand that people in 1930s Germany or other places in Europe didn't vote for genocide. They voted on economic issues. They voted because they wanted their lives to improve, because they were experiencing economic hardship. So this is not what people vote for, but this is the kind of mechanism that is used that then makes things possible. It's not like the planning of the genocide of killing 11 million Jews was part of the political agenda in the 1930s. That planning came only once the National Socialists got the state power and mechanisms of state power, including the army, including the industry behind. So if the Weimar Germany attracted intellectual classes such as church leaders, teachers, bureaucrats, industrial and commercial elites, lawyers, university professors, and provided them with sort of needed tools, that's what made it possible. That is when for whatever reason, whether it was utilitarian industrialists endorsed some of the policies. In the United States, again, we're seeing similarities, and we have to watch it where it is going to go. Again, I emphasize this is not a Weimar Republic in the 1930s. The RNC, the majority of Republican politicians, the media and pundits who are mum when you know, some of that vitriolic language is and stigmatization of religious and ethnic groups is sort of way process of normalization of that discourse. That's what's really frightening, the normalization of the discourse that would not have been acceptable before. And I want to close by just giving you two quotes. One is from February 1933 from a German Jewish newspaper, and one is from February 1939 from Hungary. So I will start with the first one. We do not subscribe to the view that Herr Hitler and his friends, now finally in possession of the power they have desired for so long, will enact their proposals. They will not suddenly divest German Jews of their constitutional rights, lock them away in race ghettos, or subject them to the avaricious and murderous impulses of the mob. They not only cannot do this, because many other crucial factors hold their power in check, but they also clearly do not want to go this route. And that's, again, something that is often being raised with Donald Trump, that, oh, there are checks in the United States, and they're just using it for political power to rile up the voters and to bring them power. And another one is from 1939 from Hungary, and this is Jewish laws, anti-Jewish laws were enacted. The politicians who view with growing anxiety the provisions of the new anti-Jewish law are afraid to utter their opinion, for if they would do so, they would be accused of being the mercenaries of Jews, and this imputation might ruin their political careers. In this struggle, Jews have no friends or allies. Labor and the remaining liberal minority, though observing with sympathy the tragedy of Jewry, weaken themselves, and they can do nothing for us but document their sympathy by touching speeches and gestures, which earn Jewry's full gratitude, but could hardly influence the events. The majority of the Gentile middle class hopes for the anti-Jewish law to improve their financial conditions, and even those who are not anti-Semites approve the government's actions because their own economic supremacy might be weakened by protecting the cause of the Jews, if they even felt inclined to do so.
So I'll close here on this pessimistic note, and we'll open it up for discussion.
Thanks to all the panelists and to everyone for having come right now.
Loans from the Putin-connected Russian bank. challenge the right-wing government about the unconstitutionality of some of the movements against the opposition and against historians. There are historians and there's, you know, censorship, increased censorship and challenge to freedom of speech. So you have that kind of tension of the response. On the one hand, they are very anti-Russian. On the other hand, they are autocratic and they are happy that the United States will not be taking charge.
Just very quickly on that subject to add, probably one reason why Angela Merkel is running again in Germany is because she looks out and she sees conceivably that she is the only bulwark there against a resurgent right, and she may become the leader of the free world anyway. But with regard to Vladimir Putin, we also have to recognize that not only is the Russian government supporting these extreme nationalist movements in other nations, but that even in Russia, one of the supports for the extreme nationalism that a former KGB agent is putting forward is the Russian Orthodox Church, which has a very strong cultural conservatism that it is also trying to defend, shall we say, throughout Europe. So that's something that's just an extra fillip to it. There were other questions, however. The gentleman in yellow had a question, and then the gentleman, I think, from Adelphi. Did you have a question? So the gentleman in yellow first.
My question was for Professor Elizabeth Howe. Despite the fact you mentioned Latino voters and Latino voters voted at a much higher rate of voting in some states away from the Southwest, away from Florida, my question is, isn't this Trump as a candidate over a year and a half supposed to be enough to galvanize the force? We've gotten out of the huge vote, the sleeping giant Latino voter, and why do you think
some of the questions were very, very specific as to what issues brought them to their position. And they do identify immigration as one of the biggest ones. Something that was very surprising to me that was that about 50% of them said that it was that they were voting for Clinton because of a sense of fellowship, of brotherhood with their fellow Latinos. And that's also about a group like Puerto Ricans who have no issue whatsoever with immigration. That they voted in a way to support their fellow Latinos in those Mexicans and those Central Americans. What happens with what the media has been saying about Latinos, this silent minority that Nixon brought up, that Trump has brought up again, is that the representation of the conservative Latino is very much distorted as well, in that in trying to present both sides of the issue, at times they interview a few people that support Clinton, a few people that support Trump, and it makes it seem like it's highly balanced, but it isn't in any way. Again, not even close. And we have been seeing this since 2008, and then again in 2012, when we forget now that McCain was a bit of anti-immigrant himself, that Romney was also a bit anti-immigrant, and that in some places like Colorado and New Mexico, where the Latino population doesn't have major immigration issues because they have been living there for so long, they also identify immigration. That they, again, it has nothing to do with them, yet they said that immigration played a big factor. Since I have the microphone again, I'll just say one tiny thing. We hear about the numbers of the millions of undocumented immigrants that will be deported, and now Trump has scaled down to only those who are criminals. That number, the number of undocumented immigrants who are criminals, is incredibly tiny because immigrants overall commit very little crime. The undocumented, way less than that. They don't want to expose themselves. So the total number of undocumented immigrants who are Latinos is about 80 million, primarily Mexican. Of those, very, very few are criminals. He has said that 2 or 3 million of them will be deported. He will not find 2 or 3 million of undocumented criminals in the U.S. He will not find them in the tens of thousands either. So if people worry about that, I do worry for those who will be targeted, but it's a number that is very, very tiny. We hear again about the undocumented criminals. They essentially do not exist. Something that might surprise some of you is that living in the U.S. not a crime. If you came in illegally, if you came in with a student visa and then you overstayed your visa, you are not committing a crime by living in the U.S. So just saying, well, they live in the U.S. without documents, therefore they are criminals, they're actually not. That is not a crime at all.
This is something, though, that the current nominee for attorney general would like to change. Would like to criminalize existence.
In doing so, you'd be targeting about 60,000 Irish who live in the country without documents. They did not swim across the ocean. They overstay. Like hundreds of thousands of Canadians do. They go to the U.S. legally and then they just overstay. Neither they, those Canadians, those Irish, tens of thousands of Australians, none of them, or Mexicans or Central Americans who did cross illegally, once here, none of them is committing a crime. Again, that in itself is not a crime. If they change it, it'll be a huge historical precedent for the U.S. To do that, but then that would make criminals of them. Highly likely, which is the case with crossing into the U.S. illegally, it'll be a minor violation. Because crossing into the U.S. illegally, which is a crime, is a minor violation, which may result in you receiving a $300 fine. That is it. So that in itself is not a major crime at all, it's just a violation. Yeah, that would bring tremendous legal implications if, in volunteering to give your information for the DREAM Act, you provided information that then the government can use against you. I imagine we'd be fought in the courts. And one thing that we have the strongest generation of Latino lawyers who are very much involved in immigration. We have the strongest generation of women politicians in the U.S. Who are ready to fight against any type of abuse. So that again, it is highly concerning that these again the DREAM Act for kids specifically aimed at kids, that they provide their information that now that may be used against them. I truly doubt that will be the case because of the legal implications.
I think one of the things there is that there will, however, be a lot of harassment. I grew up on the border in Texas, and routinely when I would drive back to my college, Notre Dame in Indiana, with Latino students who are also at Notre Dame, when we were inside the United States border, we were routinely stopped by the Border Patrol. And that Border Patrol is going to be expanded now. And so I think what you're going to see is a level of initial harassment of Latinos generally, I'm sorry to say, and then it will be teased out probably in the courts. But I don't think that anybody can avoid the fact that there is going to be a level of intense scrutiny going on the border once January 20th rolls around.
Yeah, whether that translates into actual deportations, so a joke that I made, which is maybe a little sad now, maybe sadder than before, is that if you want to find your documented immigrants, I can tell you exactly where they are. They're not that difficult to spot. They're picking all of your fruits and vegetables in the U.S. They're out in the open where immigration services can find them anytime. It's just that the states, the counties, the cities don't want them to do that because they need them as workers. If they get deported, other immigrants will have to come. So they will be replaced. We forget that, again, that the local governments and the state governments are very much pro undocumented immigrants when it comes to actually going after them. They do not. Meaning they do not go after them. They don't want the federal government to do anything about this. And the current political scene has to come to terms with that because it doesn't make a lot of sense, but that has been the status quo for decades.
I'm going to just go around the people who have had hands up. A gentleman from Adelphi, and then a woman in the pink scarf, a woman in the front row, and then Professor Paul in the back. So that's four people, and then we'll go on from there. Sir?
Yeah, I just want to add an asterisk to what you said. I am myself Puerto Rican, and I do care about the undocumented. There are many of us that are nationalists and even non-nationalists that do consider the other. That because, as a matter of fact, I call the Puerto Rican the undocumented citizen. because many of us are profiled, and I've been arrested because I don't admit that I am a Puerto Rican and a citizen, in order to show the police that they cannot keep doing this. And many of us operate with that concern for the other. And another asterisk as it relates to the Latino population, because of the myth of the American dream, that many immigrants and people in the United States have bought into that myth, and that truly destroys the numbers. It really creates a dysfunction as to who's Latino and how we're voting, because the white Latinos have a tendency to vote not as a Latino, but as I'm white. Yeah. And that's all I want to say with Latino, but I do have, yes, go ahead.
Can I just say a little, well, no, ask a question. I have a comment on what you said, if there's something.
Okay, and you know, and I'm going to stay domestically, because I think if we all read Bonhoeffer and knew how his stories went, we would have a better idea to what's going on in the United States. But I have found that as a comment, that the United States, as it relates to the Democrats, quote, and Republicans, that I have found both to be solidly connected and weave into being fascists, both of them, that I find very little difference between a Democrat who is really, when you study it and look into it, a neoliberal, that have actually sold democracy and are really tied into Citizens United. I mean, when Roe versus Wade came out, not when they came out, when Scalia died, and President Obama recommended someone, we did nothing about it. You know, I have a radio station, and I said I would burn the United States flag if Obama would recommend someone, and they did nothing about it. Because some reason, this country thought that that Hillary, rightfully so, she was more of an incumbent, that she would have won anyway, so, you know, we'll wait it out, we'll put in our Supreme Court justice. Now we're stuck with Citizens United, and we're stuck with Wade and Roe, because we did absolutely nothing about it when we had a chance to do it. You know, things that are happening now, when Putnam said something about affecting the elections or other people, well, going back to Latin America, the United States has influenced every election in South America, every election in South America. So what we complain about the Republicans, the Democrats are just as vicious. And that's a problem of academia and everything else. And, you know, I could go on forever, but.
Can I just maybe?
I'm happy to.
Good questions, and then one more from Professor Paul, and then we'll come around to the answers. How is that?
I
symposium on the historian's task in the world after truth. So we will be talking about that. Let's come back to answer all of these questions. The question about education, do you want to restate it very quickly?
Crisis. There disaster crisis where the rural communities in small towns were suffering because of the move to urban area. So that's another place to think about. And you know, reaching out, and I think education is exactly what needs to be done, but it's a very slow and one-on-one kind of process.
One of the reasons why specifically in Texas, which is a highly regarding the Latino population, highly Mexican, the history of misogyny is very clearly there among Mexicans. A very telling number, though, would be how Latinos, specifically in the Southwest, voted in 2012 for Obama and for Clinton, and the numbers for Clinton went way, way up. It's not as optimistic as you might think, because that might tell you the other aspect of Latino Mexicans and their history of racism against people of African descent, that perhaps they're more racist than they're misogynistic in this regard. But I have a lot of reasons to be optimistic, and one of them has to do with your generation, which the generation overall of people your age is the most open-minded that we have ever had. And if millennials had been the only ones voting in this election, Clinton would have won about 500-32. It's quite incredible how open-minded you are, and I would encourage you to stay so, because you do matter. What you say to your dad does very much matter. Latinos have another prejudice, which is homophobia as well. All of those are declining with the generations. Mexicans are not as misogynistic as they used to be. Mexicans in the U.S. even less so. Younger Mexicans in the U.S. even much less so. So things are changing. We are doing better overall. So we're not quite there yet.
So I'll keep my answers short. On the question of fake news and this post-truth question, what we can do as historians is help people learn how to adjudicate sources and understand what sources are credible and what sources are not. And this is something that we do in all of our classes when we look at primary documents. I mean, it's one thing to argue about corruption or favoritism within the Democratic National Committee. It's another thing to say that a Kenyan-born Muslim president is plotting to serve a third term by allowing Hillary Clinton to win and then indict him. Right? At least one of these is patently false, and the other one is based on a particular source that we can investigate. Regarding the anti-imperialism argument and the equivalency between the Republican and the Democratic Party, I'm with you on criticizing the Democrats. But to my mind, there's one party that is engaged in wide-scale systematic voter suppression efforts as a policy of that party to maintain power, and that's the Republican Party. One party, if we look at Trump's cabinet members and their position as or cabinet nominees, I should say. I'm speaking about Jeff Sessions. This is someone who is a Republican stalwart, and this is the person who's going to be probably charged with protecting the rights of women, ethnic and religious minorities, and LGBTQ Americans. This is someone who's on the record as saying that acceptance of equality, and specifically marriage equality between gays and lesbians, is an existential threat to Western civilization. This is someone who is the most forceful anti-immigration voice in Congress at this moment, and this is someone who made his career by prosecuting people who were registering voters as part of an extended civil rights movement. So I think that the equivalency between those two parties is a false equivalency. While I agree with you that the Democrats have a lot of work and have a lot of problems. And that to resist that.
again, about a highly Mexican, the Latino population there. They're sending a woman to represent the state in the Senate, which is remarkable as well. Again, because those Latinos are recent arrivals for the most part, so more likely to be misogynistic, yet they voted to send a woman to the Senate. So that's very good news.
We're nearly out of time, so I think I will allow, we'll have our two final questions, gentlemen here, and then the alien undocumented person from Harvard.
I wish they could rethink that as well. Because they live here and we Mexico. But anyway, so it's they have a major peaceful line. They will stay so. I believe they will stay so. We have to treasure that as well, that this is not how it happens in other countries. In other countries, things do get completely out of hand, and crimes are committed, and that's not what's happening here in the U.S. And we love those. By the way, again with your kids, very young people doing this, and we should value the fact that they are doing it primarily peaceful and listen.